is an old saying. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. How then would a journey of 1,000 light years begin? I am walking outside the parameters of a suspected top-secret military testing lab, hidden deep underground here in New Mexico. Every precaution is taken to keep intruders from penetrating this electrified chain-link fence. Guard dogs, invisible alarm systems, and remote-controlled anti-personnel weapons. And yet, as we can see from our vantage point outside the fence, large black spots pepper the grounds within. Crabgrass disease? Fertilizer burns. Marks from where lightning touched the earth. Or perhaps, just perhaps, marks where another phenomena from the sky also touched down upon the earth. This is Papa Prell on the prowl. Join me as I explore the strange, bizarre, and yes, dangerous world of UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Most of us have discounted them as being jokes, but as we're about to discover, the joke may be a very serious one, and the laughs may turn into screams.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space. Yet across an immense ethereal gulf, minds that are to our minds as ours are to the beasts in the jungle, intellects, vast, cool, and unsympathetic, regarded this earth with envious eyes and slowly and surely drew their plans against us.
And so began the Orson Welles 1938 radio broadcast, The War of the Worlds. The fictional alien invasion was so realistic that it sent millions of screaming Americans running for their very lives. The panic was closely monitored by the U.S. government, which may have concluded that the mass hysteria justified a cover-up in the event of any real such emergency. But were they the only ones monitoring the event? Radio waves leave this earth and go deep into space. Who knows who, or what else, may have received them, and what conclusions they may have arrived at?
What's this all about?
But surely you know, Mr. Ryan. After all, you've been publicizing it for months.
Listen, you...
Please, do not interrupt. You see, before colonizing your planet, we Martians sent advanced scouts to study your habits, your weaknesses. We found that the people on Earth are predominantly conditioned by advertising and publicity. And so, we conceived the idea of treating our entire invasion as a vast publicity stunt. Clever, huh? After all, Mr. Ryan, who would suspect an invader who advertised his invasion in the newspaper, invited the public to his surprise attack, and spent millions publicizing his plans?
Holy jumping catfish.
You've done very well.
Then there was no product.
Ah, but there is a product. In exactly 2 minutes, our troops will treat the world to a spectacle of death, which will bring the rest of your planet to its knees in horror. Nations will clamor to surrender.
Up until now, we've heard only fictional accounts of what could happen. Now let's hear some real accounts of what has already happened. The following voices are those of the actual witnesses, or in some cases, the victims. It was late one evening when Travis Walton and his friends were driving through the woods. They saw a bright light, and Travis investigated. His friends, however, drove off in a panic.
It was hovering up here, just below the tops of the trees, and it was about 20, 25 feet in diameter. When I got up about here, I crouched down behind a log, and I could hear a sound coming from it. It was kind of a very strange mechanical sound. And I was kind of wrestling with the idea of being so close to this. I'd expected it to take off, you know, and I'd run, in running up here, I figured this was my last chance to, you know, to see this thing up close. But I decided I'd better get the hell out of there. And as I raised up and turned to go, I felt this numbing shock and blacked out. The guys in the truck said they saw this brilliant beam come out of the bottom of the craft and hit me in the head and the chest and knocked me flying through the air.
When his friends returned, there was no trace of Travis. He says he blacked out, and when he woke up, he was in an alien UFO!
I didn't regain consciousness very quickly. I was very groggy and in a lot of pain. But when I could finally focus my eyes, I saw these creatures standing over me, which just flipped me out immediately. I was pretty hysterical. I was screaming all kinds of things at them, and they started towards me, and I grabbed a thing off of the table there and lashed out at them, and they stopped. They just kind of put their hands out like that at me, and then they just turned around and left the room. And I was afraid they'd come back, so I was going to try to find a way out of there. I guess I kind of assumed I was still, you know, or that the craft was still in here in the woods. But I went looking for a way out. I went into another room, and as I was looking for a way out, another being came in. And this was a very human-appearing person. He led me out of this craft, which appeared to be parked inside of a larger building or a larger craft. He just took me right out of there, down a hallway to a room where there were some other people who looked like him. They put this mask over my face. It was kind of like an oxygen mask thing. There was no hose connected to it. They put it over my face, and that was the last thing I knew. I just blacked out.
4 days later, Travis Walton was found on the side of a road with a bump on the side of his head and a tall tail. Can't believe it? Who would you believe? Val Johnson, deputy policeman?
The light was coming at me. It was extremely bright. The inside of the car lit up. I can remember that. And it was a very dazzling, brilliant occurrence.
He imagined it? Perhaps his patrol car also imagined it. If so, it had a pretty vivid imagination. The headlights were smashed, the top bashed, the windshield shattered, and the antenna bent, just for good measure.
Something did strike my vehicle. Something didn't want me there, apparently, or it was, you know, I can't put a judgment on it. I really don't know how to classify it. I can't classify it as an attack. Perhaps it was an escape.
Remember, this was no Sterno bum, but a respected law enforcement official of Oslo, Minnesota. But perhaps you never did trust government officials, and with good reason. Then how about the government watchdogs, the journalists and newsmen? In 1978, a film crew was heading back from a documentary in New Zealand when their plane was followed by a mysterious light.
We've just heard from Wellington radar that we've got an object about a mile behind us and it's following us. Of course, we can't see it. Let's hope they're friendly. They're still there. You can see the one to the right of us are still reasonably bright. It's really getting a bit frightening up here. There's a whole formation of unidentified flying objects behind us. We'll just have to wait and see what happens.
It was recorded on film. It was spotted on radar. It was seen by the pilot and photojournalist. But it wasn't seen on the 10 o'clock news. No such thing as a cover-up. Then why did astronaut Pete Conrad wait over 24 hours before admitting to Houston that Apollo 12 was being followed by a UFO?
We've had an object which is at the same place all the time but appears to be tumbling. Well, we've had it ever since yesterday. And it just seems to be tagging along with us. Roger, Pete.
With the world listening to the mission live, the government quickly called back. They devised several explanations, but the most obvious one was missing.
That thing you saw out the hatch at a roll of 35 degrees, we figure there's probably three possible answers. Number one, it could be the S-4B or possibly a slaw panel, or it could be the backup crew flying trail on you.
The government decided on the slaw panel story. But they had a hard time selling it, even to Commander Conrad. Maybe without eye contact, he couldn't see them wink when they told it.
12, Houston.
Go ahead.
Pete, as best we can tell, looking at things down here on those slaw panels, if we assume that they weren't imparted any great amount of delta V, like anything more than 1 or so feet per second when they separated, your slaw panels would probably only be about 300 miles away from you right now.
That could be true, but gee whiz, when we turned around, I saw one of those slaw panels leaving the area at a high rate of speed. It looked to me like it was leaving us pretty rapid clip, like it got a lot more than a foot per second or so.
With no private radio channel, the government decided to play innocent and dumb. It was an act they had perfected over the years.
Well, since we don't really have any idea how they left or what their trajectory could be, it's kind of tough really to say just what the heck that could be.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
Roger. If it makes any noises, it's probably just wind in the rigging.
Phew, that was close. Nothing like laughter to break up the tension. But once back on Earth, after briefing and debriefing, the tension had returned to Commander Conrad's voice. What could he possibly be afraid of now? Listen carefully to the subtle sarcasm in his explanation.
Now, had I or Dick Gordon or Alan Bean had any concept of the fact that the opportunists in a journalistic business were going to try and capitalize on a funny conversation we had with the ground to say that we had been followed to the moon by UFOs and that we were sworn to secrecy under threat of death from the United States government not to talk about it, they're full of beans. There's just absolutely nothing to the story.
Well, you don't hear much from him anymore, do you? But if the government was really involved in the cover-up, wouldn't there be other evidence as well? Say, a paper trail? William H. Spaulding of DSW says yes.
Absolutely. Just the CIA, for example, 42 of its components have at one time or still are investigating the UFO phenomena, from psychological to R&D to weapons development, different components of the CIA. We believe that the Air Force was nothing more than a facade for the public. It took care of some investigations, but it was so smallly staffed that they couldn't handle it, and that the good material is in the hands of the OSI, a component of the CIA. And also we're finding now, which is relatively new information, that there are other intelligence agencies, including DIA and the National Security Agency, which has more paramount UFO material than that of the CIA.
In the age of the paper shredder, you may age quite a while before getting much more from that avenue. And even if you did get the information, who's going to disseminate it? Recently, the defense minister of France admitted publicly that France had been investigating UFOs for over 30 years. Why wasn't that in the headlines?
I think that the principal sources of information in the media are controlled, or at least by pressure from the government, to keep information on concerning UFOs out of general circulation. I reach that conclusion when I compare the hundreds upon hundreds of clippings I get from the small-town newspapers throughout the United States, none of which ever get carried in the wire services. The principal newspaper editors are relying quite heavily on the wire services for information.
Master Ho, expert in the paranormal and one of this nation's first college instructors in ufology, gives even more history on the grand deception.
You know, there's an interesting thing when people say, come on, there isn't any kind of cover-up, they're not covering up anything. The first thing is that the declassified forms are coming out now to show that they are. The second thing is that if, in fact, they're not covering anything up, they're going to a lot of trouble to do it. The third thing, when the United Nations had a discussion about getting together a worldwide UFO board to study the question in that context, the very first country to veto the idea was the United States. Now, obviously, we wouldn't veto it if we didn't have anything to hide.
Is it really possible that consistent and coordinated pressure has been applied for over 40 years to keep the UFO question from being seriously investigated? If so, who's applying that pressure, and why? For that answer, we turn to Kevin Randall, author of the UFO Casebook. He was just one of many researchers who informed us about the secret organization of MJ-12, codename for the Majestic 12.
In July of 1947... according to documentation we are now able to put our fingers on, something came down in Roswell, New Mexico. a farmer named, or a rancher named Max Brazil, found it on his ranch, told the local sheriff, who called the Roswell Army Airfield at the time, it later became Walker Air Force Base. The intelligence officer for the 509th Bomb Group, the only, at that time, the only atomic bomb group in the American military, went out to the Brazil ranch, saw what he had found, under orders, picked it all up. It was very lightweight metal. It was described as being as thin as newsprint, but so strong they couldn't dent it with a sledgehammer. They couldn't melt it with a blowtorch. They couldn't scrape it with the blade of a knife. Very strong material. There were beams found with hieroglyphic-type writing on a parchment-like material, something that Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer for the 509th, later said that he had never seen anything like it before. It was taken to Roswell. At Roswell, it was put on a B-29. It was shipped to Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth. I believe it was the Fort Worth Army Airfield at the time. General Roger Ramey saw the stuff, sent Marcel back to Roswell, then came out with the idea that it was a weather balloon, some kind of a radar reflecting balloon that was used in certain experimentation. The sighting died there. But subsequently, on September 24th, 1947, according to some documentation that is still being looked at, President Truman formed what he called the Majestic 12, a committee of 12 people, military officers, scientists, a few governmental people, to exploit this material found at Roswell, New Mexico. And that was their job. They became the Majestic 12. Interestingly enough, as we investigate UFO sightings, the early UFO sightings, every time we'd come into a roadblock, we would find a member of the Majestic 12. Prime example, there was a document prepared in 1948 called the Estimate of the Situation. It was an intelligence estimate about UFOs. The document claimed that UFOs were extraterrestrial spacecraft. General Hoyt S. Vandenberg, who was the head of the Air Force at the time, looked at the document, said the conclusions drawn by this report are not supported by the evidence examined in this report. He ordered the report destroyed. It was a top-secret report. Hoyt S. Vandenberg had been a member of the Majestic 12. It became incumbent upon him to remove anything from the public scrutiny that would suggest UFOs or extraterrestrial spacecraft. That was kind of the mission of the Majestic 12, that and to exploit any other subsequent crashes if they would happen so that they didn't get into the trouble like they did at Roswell. Roswell got out because it was the first. They didn't know what they were doing. If there were subsequent crashes, they moved immediately to bury the information from the public.
Just what sort of power does the Majestic 12 hold? Apparently the power of life and death.
I think specifically of Warren Smith, a UFO researcher from Clinton, Iowa, who in the mid-1960s was given a piece of metal supposedly from a UFO, was seen to come from a UFO. And he was visited in his hotel room by two men who told him that if you want to believe we're CIA, we're CIA. If you want to believe we're FBI, we're FBI. But the point was, they took the sample of metal and went away with it. And we don't know where that metal went. There are a lot of stories like that beginning to surface where researchers have had their evidence taken from them by representatives of the government. So you don't have the proof to offer to the scientific community.
And as if the government wasn't doing enough to keep the UFO conspiracy secret, the aliens themselves may have the power to control just who sees them and when. Again, Master Ho, expert in the paranormal.
I wasn't going to tell you this story, but I will anyway. I went to a full moon meditation one night with a group of friends. And altogether, there were 40 people. And at the end of the meditation, we went out to a balcony that was overlooking the valley. And there, hovering big as life, like a basketball in the sky, was this UFO. There were 40 people there. 6 people could see it. 34 could not. Now, I don't know how to account for a phenomena like that. Here were the people that could see it going, "Can't you see that? It's so big, it's so clear, it's hovering right in front of your face." And the 34 people going, "We don't see anything at all." The 6 who saw it all saw the same thing. Now, the only explanation I can come up with for that is either A, the aliens can pick or choose who they will let see them, and that's a very good possibility, or B, because certain people have learned how to develop those senses to a higher rate, they are able to see what the other people are not.
And just who are these aliens whose identities are so secret? What do they look like, and where do they come from? Mary Mason, an expert in alien design, gives us some gory details.
And what happened was that we had to somehow take this creature with the body of a squid, with the legs of sort of an attenuated grasshopper with a couple extra joints in there, two legs and a squid body suspended between it. One, reconcile how this thing ambulated and could live, and two, figure out what kind of culture it would have. What we came up with was the fact that because the planet it was on was extremely violent weather and extremely changeable and things, this creature communicated by dance, both by feeling the rhythms of the other dance through its feet and by seeing the other dance.
Then there's the decapods, with not six, not eight, but 10 insect feelers coming at you like this.
This thing that looked like sort of a giant cockroach with 10 limbs, so we called it the decapods. And the decapods wound up, you know, becoming a very, very extensive culture. A couple of us who are interested in brain physiology sat down and developed the central nervous system for the creature. And suddenly we realized what it meant to not have the brain confined in a skull, but to let it extend through this large carapace, to let it move, to let it reorganize itself.
You won't be able to repel a raid of those creatures with raid insecticide, and they're too big to squash with your feet. So Miss Mason recommends offering them a hand with a TV in it.
Would be to set out a television set, take a closed-circuit video camera, begin going through greeting rituals, human to human, and demonstrate benevolent greeting rituals that both survive, and go through these things and begin to pattern behavior and see if we can get a response back. And at first communicate electronically before you attempt to communicate physically. Because if we wave hello, and that turns out to mean your sister sucks little green bunnies in alien gestures, they may kill the television, but we'll probably survive. So just for safety's sake, that would seem like a great place to start. And, of course, there's the traditional start for communication, which is bip, 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 bip. There's several things that we can assume are reasonably universal by anything with enough technology to get here, and that would be counting and the periodic table.
Now that's assuming you want to talk with the aliens. Different types of aliens means different types of cultures, and not all cultures are friendly. Remember the American Indian? They were also visited by many races of aliens who also crossed an impossible sea of space, or rather, space of sea. They were the olive-skinned creatures with the metal-covered heads from a place called Spain, the pale short-haired variety from a different place called England, and also the dark, bearded, long-haired variety from France. All these creatures spoke different tongues, wore different uniforms, and looked very different from the native red man. When they finally were understood, they spoke of peace and friendship. Until that time, however, they can make you explode in fire just by pointing a metallic tube at you. Perhaps most disturbing is the fact that the pacifists that helped the aliens and the warriors that fought them all wound up in similar circumstances, either dead or left to die in the most desolate, unwanted portions of their own continent. All the amazing New World gifts, be they beads, firewater, or chicken pox, ended up being worth as much as the treaties they accompanied. Now, I don't know about you, but if aliens are people too, I'm not sure I trust them. So let's have a look at some of the less flattering accusations against our space brothers, shall we? Again, author Kevin Randall.
No, if I've given you the impression they're benevolent, I certainly didn't mean to do so. If you take a look at the abduction cases, and I think of the ones specifically that I've investigated, there is no suggestion they're benevolent in any way, shape, or form. They are more like our scientists moving in on studying something from the animal kingdom that we found, dragging people out of their environment and subjecting them to various psychological and physical tests, stress tests, making them relive past experiences through manipulation of various kinds, through truth serums or hypnosis, that sort of thing, so that they can gain their information, and putting the people back into their environment with these traumatic kind of experiences. No, there's nothing to suggest they're benevolent.
It was late New Year's night, 1961, when Betty and Bonnie Hill drove from a party on a deserted country road. Yes, they had had a few drinks, but not near enough to prepare them for the terror that was about to embrace them. It said what you do on New Year's is what you'll be doing the rest of the year. That would be a grim prophecy indeed for the Hills, for they, like so many other unsuspecting humans, were about to be abducted by aliens.
Why are we stopping?
You know why we're stopping.
Barney, we're married now. We can wait till we get home.
No, we can't.
Barney, you animal. If anyone saw us, it would be so embarrassing.
Nobody's gonna see us.
I don't know, Barney. It seems risky. Out here in the middle of nowhere, on the shoulder of the road, anyone could pass by.
We'd see their headlights long before they got here. Now relax.
I can't relax. Hear that noise? What is it?
My breathing.
No, it's something else. Can't you hear it?
You're imagining it.
No, I'm not. There's someone's headlight shining in the window. Let's get out of here.
All right. No sense of adventure.
Why aren't we moving?
I don't know. I got the gas on. Wait a minute. We are moving. We're floating upward. What's going on?
They blacked out. And when they revived, they were aboard a strange craft, where a giant map panel cast an eerie glow on the face of a fleshy-headed alien. Luckily, they were released, but only after a series of grueling, painstaking tests. Their experience would only be revealed years later under hypnotism, and the significance of those experiences later still in the 80s. Master Ho, paranormal expert, explains.
And there are three things in that story, when we look at it, now that we realize makes sense that didn't make sense then. One is that she was being approached with an alien with a long needle who said he was doing a pregnancy test. She said, that's no pregnancy test here. In the 60s it wasn't, in the 80s it is. She described being connected to small needles with cables that went to a television set. Didn't make a lot of sense in 61, but in the 80s we can see that might very well be some form of computer for medical evaluations. And also, and far more importantly, she drew a map, which in 61 everybody poo-pooed because it didn't make any sense to them. Well, if we draw a map of the stars, we draw it from the Earth looking out. That's natural. Earth is our home. But if anything was coming from the stars, they'd be drawing it from the outside looking down towards the Earth. And 10 years later, Marjorie Fish, working with a computer, put in information that no one had back in the 60s. And when she put out her computer map of the stars in reverse, there was Betty Hill's map, which she had seen aboard a UFO and had drawn under hypnosis.
I asked Kevin Randall if he felt certain all the abductees were being returned. His response wasn't very reassuring.
I think, there you've gone off on one that I hadn't really thought about. The suspicion is that anyone who is abducted is brought back, but there's really no reason to believe that, is there? If somebody was to disappear off the face of the earth, they would become a missing person, and people would search for them. And if they were never found, it would be one of those weird cases. Obviously, the people I've talked to have all been brought back. Otherwise, I wouldn't have talked to them.